Welcome to the course called Green's Functions. So the course will consist of four lectures, and I have just written down the topics of the first two lectures. So this course is pretty much important because Green's functions play an important role. They played a very important role starting from 19th century and were and the machinery of Green's functions developed in the middle of 19th century by British mathematician Andrew Green became very useful for subsequent applications in classical mechanics as well as electromagnetism. So in the whole area of classical physics that gained a lot of development at the very end of 19th century especially, and also, of course, at the beginning of the 20th century. But moreover, the machinery of the Green's functions became very important during the development of quantum mechanics. You can employ Green's functions when you deal with Schrodinger equations. You can prove the whole series of theorem just constructing the Green's functions from the Schrodinger equations. And later, when physicists started the development of the path integral approach, Green's functions began to play even more important role. So I don't have time, because I have only four lectures, to talk about applications of Green's functions in quantum mechanics and field theory. You will see them in the courses on quantum field theory later. But rather, I will familiarize you with the more conventional and more general theorems and applications that are applicable to the equations of mathematical physics that describe the whole range of classical phenomena. So I will write the words Green's functions because those functions belong to physicist Green. And I will try to avoid writing Green functions, albeit in the literature people now write Green functions like green leaves, green grass. So I will try to pay respect to mathematician Andrew Green and write Green's functions. So here you see the outline of topics for the first two lectures. So I will talk about, first of all, Green's functions for simple one-dimensional differential equations and the notion of self-adjoint operators and how one constructs Green's functions for self-adjoint differential operators. I will consider the Sturm-Liouville problem and the corresponding boundary conditions as an example when the differential operators can be self-adjoint. And I mentioned today the eigenfunction expansion. So during the second lecture, I will remind you about Fourier transform. Hopefully you know those. It will serve as a reminder mostly. Fourier transform and the properties of Fourier transform, because Fourier transform is the most standard way to construct Green's functions. I will talk about causal Green's functions. So what happens if you solve simple differential equations that have source? Source, the non-homogeneous differential equations with the non-zero right-hand side. And then I will mention about the partial differential equations, how to classify them. But this will be tomorrow during the second lecture. So let's start. I will move this board up and start. So consider some differential operator L. L is a differential operator that is one dimensional and acting on some space of square integral function on some segment between A and B. So if we have a simple segment A and B and consider some functions for x belonging to the segment A and B, so they should be square integrable. In other words, let's consider differential operator acting in the space of sufficiently differentiable, sufficiently integrable functions, better to say smooth functions. And the most important thing is that L in general can be presented in the following form. P naught is a function of x times the nth derivative plus p1 is a function of x times xn minus 1 derivative and so forth plus some function pn of x. Those functions p0, p1, and so forth up to pn are supposed to be one-dimensional, smooth, a real function. So this is the most general form of the differential operator. And we wish to solve the equation. This is how Green's functions are introduced for one-dimensional differential operator. L acting on y, well, it's also a function of x, equal to some other function of x. We assume that function f is also sufficiently differentiable, sufficiently integrable, in other words, sufficiently smooth function. And this differential equation must be supplemented somehow by the suitable boundary conditions that are not contradictory to each other. This is also implied. Then the question is, what is the solution to this equation? Formal solution. What is the solution? And the answer is that it can be represented in the following form. Y equal to the inverse operator, L minus 1 is the operator inverse to L, acting on F. This is just a formal solution. And if L is the differential operator, then we can imagine that L minus 1 is an operator that is represented by an integral kernel, namely L minus 1, depending on x, of course, and some other parameter psi, equal to some function g of two parameters, x and psi, where psi is also a coordinate that varies between a and b. Then we can write that L, differential operator acting on x, variable acting on g as a function of x and psi, equal to the delta function x minus psi. So this is in fact the definition of the Green's function for this differential operator L. Well, I hope everyone knows what delta function is. So what delta function is. So if we know g as a function of x and psi, then we can write our solution y of x equal to the integral between a and b, g of x psi times dx, or let's just say, sorry, times f psi dx. So if we know g, we know the right-hand side f, and we can find the solution y. Xi, absolutely. Thank you. Yeah. So xi also the variable that varies between a and b. So the proof is very easy and relies on the definition of delta function. So to prove this, we write L acting to y. So this integral between a and b, L acts on x variable in function g, dx psi f psi dxi. And since this is a delta function, x minus psi, then we recover f of x. This is just how Green's functions is introduced But what you see here is just a formal procedure, because the question is, how can we construct Green's function g as a function of two variables now, x and xi? So before I explain the recipe, the procedure how to construct it, let me talk about self-adjoint differential operators. So we can imagine quite many differential operators. The most general form is written above. But what is important for us is that we construct Green's functions for self-adjoint differential operators, because the procedure for those subclass of differential operators is quite straightforward. So self-adjoint, and I will spend quite some time talking what self-adjoint differential operators are. Self-adjoint differential operators. So suppose we have L. We have L and weight function W of x. This function is also sufficiently smooth, real, positive on a on the segment A and B. Then we can find another operator, also differential operator L dagger, another L dagger, such that for some other functions u of x and v of x, other functions also defined on the segment A and B. What is important is that those two functions are sufficiently differentiable. Well, it's always convenient to assume that those are nice functions. We find another L dagger such that for any functions u and v, we have the following expression: w u dagger L acting on v minus v L dagger acting on u star equal to d over dx, the differential of some function of u and v, where q as a function of u and v depends bilinearly on u and v. So in other words, we can find differential operator L dagger so that the right-hand side of this equation is a full derivative of some complicated function of u and v, where q depends bilinearly on this function. So we, for generality, write that functions u and v and complex. But it's not very essentially so, because if a differential operator is itself real, then we can always work in the space of real functions. So it's not essential, it's just more just convenience to write in this form. So such an operator L dagger can always be found. So from this definition, once we construct L dagger, we say that L dagger is the adjoint operator to L. Once this holds, L dagger is called the adjoint operator to L. This equation, or better to say, this identity is called Lagrange identity. So we can use some other notations to represent the Lagrange identity in the same form. So if one defines this construction with the square brackets, u comma v in the square brackets with index w as an integral from a to b from w, u dagger v times dx, then we can write the Lagrange identity in the following form. Then this identity is written as square bracket u, comma l v, here index w minus l dagger u, comma v, equal to q as a function of u and v taken between the limits b and a. So this notation is more convenient. It's just another notation of the same thing, but this notation is more used in linear algebra, just in more common, because the concepts, theorems in those things are quite identical to those used in linear algebra. Finally, another definition. If once L dagger is constructed and it appears to be equal to L, then the operator L is called self-adjoint. If L equal to L dagger, then L is called self-adjoint. Self-adjoint. The important thing that if we take any differential operator with arbitrary functions, p-naught, and so forth, that there is no absolutely guarantee that L is self-adjoint. We must check that Lagrange identity fulfills. One may ask a question whether this is all. The answer is this is not all, because we can have that L is equal to L dagger, and we have a self-adjoint operator. But there is another notion for the operator. The operator can be not simply self-adjoint, but it is called truly self-adjoint if it acts in the space of functions that satisfy boundary conditions at points A and B. The operator is called L is truly self-adjoint if it acts in the space of functions. So by functions we mean the functions u and v, because L acts on u and v of functions u and v that satisfy the condition q u comma v taken between the limits b and a equal to zero. So this just means that we further limit the condition of our problem. We treat differential operators not simply satisfying this identity, but also acting on in the space of functions that render the right-hand side of Lagrange identity zero. So any questions at that point?
Could you also define this for non-bounded intervals with g going to
zero? You mean at the boundary? So this is the general condition. So you can consider the infinite segment. So from minus infinity to infinity. In this case, we say that the functions are supposed to decay sufficiently fast, and its derivatives at the infinity. The segment A and B can be infinite, of course. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So are you saying that self-adjoint and truly self-adjoint are two different things?
Well, they are similar. Simply, when we talk about truly self-adjoint, we place another restrictions on the space of function, where the adjoint operator acts. So this is how I think those things are defined in mathematical physics. Okay, let's consider one very famous example. Sturm-Liouville problem. Well, in German it is called Sturm-Liouville, so. Let's consider the operator. Sturm-Liouville problem. L equal to P naught D2 over DX squared plus P1 D over DX plus P2. Well, P naught, P1, and P2 are functions of X. I'm simply skipping those notations for brevity. So L is self-adjoint with respect to weight function omega equal to 1 if and only if P naught prime equal to P1, meaning that L can be written in the following form. And I will denote this by double star. L equal to D over DX of P naught D over DX plus P2. Yeah, 2 here. Yeah, since P1 is equal to P naught prime, we can write down our differential operator in this form. So the proof is simple. It's just a simple algebra. You can prove the direct statement and the reverse statement. So if this relation holds, then operator L is self-adjoint. Now let's consider when L becomes truly self-adjoint. As I said, we must consider L acting in the space of functions satisfying boundary conditions. And here we will do some algebra. So when L is truly self-adjoint, so what we need to do, we need to consider the difference presented above, the Lagrange identity in the integral form. So we write U L V with respect to omega equal to 1, not the atomic bulk, but W, sorry, minus L dagger U, comma V, W is equal to 1, equal 2. So, and let's do here the algebra, the integral over U dagger, here D over DX, V naught D over DX, acting on V, plus E to V DX, minus A and B, the integral from A to B, D over DX, V naught D over DX. This acts on U star plus P2 U star V DX. So we just wrote down the identity given above. So let's now do integration by parts. So this, what is written here, can be represented as an integral from A to B, d over dx of the following, u star p naught. I will write v prime. So v prime is the derivative with respect to x. And I hope this is clear. Minus v p naught u star prime dx. So is this clear? This is just the application of Lagrange identity. So, and when we write this, so as P naught taken at B, U star taken at B, V prime taken at B, minus V at B, U star prime at B, minus P naught at A, U star at A, V prime at A, minus V at A, U star prime at A. Then P naught is a general arbitrary function. So P naught at B is different from P naught at A. And to require the truly self-adjointness, we must set it equal to zero. So because P naught is arbitrary, we require that expressions in square brackets are identically equal to zero. This gives us the boundary conditions. The boundary conditions, U star prime at A divided by U at A star equal to V prime at A divided by V at A, and the same at B, U prime star at B divided by U star at B equal to V prime at B divided by V at B. So again, since functions U and V are arbitrary, those boundary conditions can be rewritten in the following form. And the form I will write is the most commonly used form. It is not difficult to see that these forms are identical. We write alpha at A, where alpha is some parameter, y of A plus B A, y prime at A equal to zero, and alpha B, y b plus beta b y prime at b equal to 0. So all functions on which operator L acts must satisfy these boundary conditions. So it is easy to check that these forms are identical. So alphas and betas are arbitrary constants. Yeah. Sorry? Well, I simply wrote the same equations in the different form. So L acts in the space of functions U and V. So we consider that L acts on Ys. So all our functions we work on satisfy these boundary conditions. Uh-huh. Yeah. B. I will try to write in bigger script, in bigger font. Okay. Here A and B. So alphas and betas are just constants. So these conditions are called homogeneous boundary conditions. That make operator L truly self-adjoint. So, real. Well, you can, if you look at the equation, you can always set one of parameters equal to one. Yeah, it's just how it is written. Say set alpha A and alpha B equal to one. This won't change anything. Yeah. L acts on the space of some functions, U and V. So, but in the equation, L acts on Y. So if we impose these boundary conditions on all the functions, then we have the well-posed Sturm-Liouville problem. Only.
Mm-hmm. So here, U and B are both inside the space.
Yeah.
So that's the reason why alpha and beta must be
real. Yeah. So yeah, these are real. But as a case, you can always sort of set one parameter equal to one of alpha or beta equal to one. This won't change anything. But simply, this is how these equations are written in the textbook. So why did they write the word homogeneous? Because the right hand side are exactly zero. So when we talk about homogeneous differential equations, what do we mean in the theory of differential equations? Of course, we mean that the right hand side is always zero. So when we talk about boundary conditions, we also mean similar things. We have the right-hand side equal to zero. We construct the linear combinations of functions and their derivatives at the boundaries and set the right-hand side equal to zero. If they are not equal to zero, then the boundary condition is called unhomogeneous. I will mention at the end of the lecture how to make a simple generalization to inhomogeneous boundary conditions. So this is what homogeneous means. When we deal with differential equations and corresponding boundary conditions. So we are now at the position to consider the recipe how to construct Green's function for self-adjoint differential operators satisfying homogeneous boundary conditions. Right, it's probably better to go here. So the recipe I will provide to you is very general and can be always used. When we deal with infinite space, basically with A and B are equal to infinity, then probably at for some problems it's better to use Fourier expansions, but I will first give you the most general prescription. So how to construct? How to construct G as a function of x, comma psi. So what do we have? We have L acting on x of G of x, comma psi equal to delta function. I put subscript x to indicate that all differentiation is done with respect to variable x. So what does this mean? This just means that everywhere, so we have a segment A, B, psi somewhere in between, and have two regions, x smaller than psi and x greater than psi. So meaning that everywhere for x not equal to psi, we have L acting on x variable of g equal to zero. And this is what? This is the homogeneous differential equation. So the right hand is zero. We deal with homogeneous differential equation. And when we have this, we can formally write down the solutions for x smaller than psi and for x greater than psi. First, let's denote the solution for x smaller than psi with subscript smaller. G smaller, x comma psi, equal to A of psi times sum function y1 of x plus B of psi function y2 of x. And when x is this is x smaller than psi. And when x is greater than psi, we have g greater of x comma psi equal to c as some function of psi with times y1 large of x plus d as a function of some function of psi times large y2 of x. So pay attention to the following. Green's function is a function of two parameters, x and psi. But we keep in our solution psi as a parameter entering the constants of the general solution, the most general solution of differential equations.
Yeah.
Because those functions A, B, C, and D must be determined from the conditions at x equal to psi. So absolutely, yes. There are four functions because we assume that our differential operator is the second order differential operator. Yes, yes. Otherwise, there will be more functions, yes.
But
Well, I said the boundary conditions for the functions.
Sure, but for example, if you had an operator to say diagonal part of the bill of function, like something like d theta or sinus theta, d theta, for example, then you would have a p naught function, which is zero in, say, 0 and 2 pi, and you wouldn't need to have the boundary conditions.
Well, this is just the most general treatment, I believe. Okay, can you talk about this later? Yeah, because about those issues, because I must present some more things. So suppose we found the solutions to this homogeneous equation as a function of x, and well, you probably know that the general solutions to the second order differential equation must contain two independent constants, so a and b. So let's make them not simply constants, but the functions of parametric psi. So these are the first two steps to find the solutions here and here. Our task is then to determine a, b, c, and d. So the other steps, I do exactly this, three. What do we have for Green's functions? We have that the boundary conditions must be satisfied. This just means that we plug our solutions to these boundary conditions and have two more equations, a, alpha a, g smaller, a, comma xi, plus b, a, g smaller prime, a, comma xi, equal to 0. And the fourth condition is alpha b, g greater than b, comma xi, plus beta with subscript b, g greater prime, comma b, xi, equal to 0. These are the equations that follow from the conditions of satisfaction, those boundary conditions. So we have two relations, and what? We need two more, right? We need two more. So so, condition five. The condition five is obtained when we impose the condition that Green's function is continuous at x equal to xi. This means that g greater of xi comma xi equal to g smaller xi comma xi. Well, I think this is natural, because when we deal with the smooth functions, we want to obtain as a solution also a smooth function. However, the derivative of Green's functions must undergo a jump at x equal to xi. And we have the sixth condition, g greater xi comma xi minus g smaller derivative xi comma xi equal to 1 over p naught at xi. This follows, this last condition follows from integrating Lx acting on g of x xi equal to delta x minus xi around the point x equal to xi. So we basically have the point x equal to xi within this segment and integrate over infinitesimal segment around this point. This is how we can derive this condition. Green's function itself is continuous at x equal to xi, but its derivative with respect to x undergoes a jump. Yeah.
How did you justify that
the Green's function is it's a good question, actually. Right. But more important, I believe that we intend to find the solution that is itself continuous. I mean, yeah. Yeah, that's right, actually. But there must be some more vivid explanation to this more mathematical why Green's function. So,
if you construct your solution, then the solution would not be continuous if you integrate or something like that, right? Because then the solution would also have
a jump. Okay, I will think about this. I will think more about this. So, So the point I believe here, if we look at our Sturm-Liouville problem, we already have the first derivative with respect to x, right? And if we assume that Green's function is itself discontinuous, then delta function would come from the first derivative in the right-hand side. Then the question is, what would come from the second derivative? But it's just a crude explanation that is in agreement with what you have just said. So then the question will be, what if you take the second derivative at point x equal to xi, then you will have the first derivative of delta function, right? Then you won't obtain the solution I provided to you at the beginning of the lecture. But I'm sure there is a much more strict derivation or, but to say, explanation to a question. It's just very, very formal. So, okay, so then the general solution based on what I have written, so can be written in the following form. So when we determined all coefficients, or better to say functions of xi A, B, C, and D, then we can write the general solution. The general solution is y of x equal to y1 of x times integral from x to b, a of xi, f of xi, dxi, plus y2 of x integral from x to b, b of xi, f xi dxi plus y1 latch as a function of x integral from a to x c of xi dxi plus y2 of x integral. Sorry, xb, right, ax, yeah, ax, d of xi, d xi. So this is the general solution to our problem for the case of Sturm-Liouville problem where we deal with just the second-order differential operator. So during your tutorial, you will have exactly two exercises that will allow you to practice implementing all these steps. This will be today. So step one, step two, step three, step four, step five, step six, and finally writing down the solution. So in general, this procedure is quite lengthy. From the boundary conditions. Our problem is well posed only when we have these homogeneous boundary conditions.
Yeah, and my question is, how do you know alpha A, beta A, coefficient from the boundary conditions?
These are conditions of the problem. Alpha and beta are the conditions of the problem. They are given. We have differential operator plus boundary conditions. That's all. Yeah.
Maybe this is obvious, but I'm not sure how we can translate these conditions within the terms of y to these conditions within.
Well, we have the problem: the differential operators acting in the space of functions on all functions that is satisfying these boundary conditions, right? Okay. How can you translate when you? Okay. So, okay. When you write down the formal solution, y, right, equal to g y of x, x comma xi, f of xi, d xi, right? Then you so between a and b, then what you do, you set here x equal to a and x equal to b, right? And substitute there. Because function f of xi is arbitrary, then you have to translate these boundary conditions here. Yeah. You can determine A, B, C, and D. From the boundary conditions, you get just two relations, but you need two more. Plus this. Yeah. Right. The system of four equations. So the expressions, the general expressions are too lengthy to present. So it's better to practice this exercise on specific forms of differential operators rather than in general. Etienne, I hope just I answered your question. Yeah. Okay. So good. Very good. So you have chance to practice this. So a couple of notes. that are quite important. So, note one. So the solution given above is not applicable. Is not applicable for inhomogeneous boundary conditions. Boundary conditions. Well, for example, y of a equal to a not equal to 0, and y at b equal to b not equal to 0. So the question is what to do in this case. And the answer is very simple. Consider the equation L acting on some function y of h equal to 0. This is a homogeneous differential equation, right? Homogeneous differential equation that can be solved in such a way that function y of h, so it's, if L is a second order differential operator, then we will have two constants. And we have two boundary conditions. So solve L acting on y h equal to 0 and obtain the solution y h of x such that y of h equal to at point a equal to a and y of h at b equal to b. So the general solution, that's the general solution, will be y of x equal to yh of x plus ys of x, where ys of x is the solution of L y of x, L acting on y s of x equal to f of x, solution satisfying homogeneous boundary conditions. Conditions. Basically, the solution given above. So, in order to consider the problem for inhomogeneous boundary conditions, we need to make one more step and to add one more solution.
I don't really get why of A is equal to A.
Why of H?
Well, I mean, like, why it is inhomogeneous by boundary condition? Because I think if, like, the derivative of Y at A and B is sufficiently given, that perhaps it can still be the homogeneous.
Just to repeat your questions. I could use, of course, more generals. It's just an example. I could use more general boundary conditions when we have the linear combination of the function and its derivative. So the general theorem states that that's the general theorem applicable to all differential equations, that the most general solution of an inhomogeneous differential equation is always a sum of a general solution of the homogeneous differential equation and one specific or better say any solution of the inhomogeneous differential equation. This is the most general theory applicable to all differential equations. So it must be the sum. Yeah, they are inhomogeneous. Yeah, yeah.
But we don't really know whether it has sufficient.
Yeah, they are inhomogeneous. If you look at what was written before, then remember I drew your attention to the fact that the right hand side is zero. Derivative. Well, you have alpha y plus beta y prime equal to zero. What if you put beta equal to zero? You will have, so if beta equal to zero, I took just the specific case simply for simplicity because you will have this problem in the tutorial. So if beta is equal to zero, then the condition is y of equal to zero. Right. I should have really written in the more general. So, but typically, what people consider, they rarely use this condition. They impose either the function itself equal to zero, or they impose the condition on the derivative. So either so-called Dirichlet boundary conditions or Neumann boundary conditions. This is the most general case. It is considered the Cauchy boundary conditions. I will mention about this tomorrow. I hope I just clarified. This is just it is important that this boundary condition contains only the function itself and its first derivative. It cannot contain higher derivatives. This is very, very important. So note two, and this note is also very, very important, but quite confusing, because if you look at the literature regarding this topic, say, do a Google search, what this means, that there are quite many questions related to this thing. So Fredholm alternative. Question. Does the solution to Ly equal to F exist and if it does, whether it is unique. So this question is very important, because I gave you the general recipe. And following this recipe, you are supposed to obtain four equations that determine A, B, C, and D. But the question is, does this system of equations have a solution? There is no guarantee. You will do this prescription, construct everything, write down equations for A, B, C, and D, and all of a sudden you may find out that this system of solutions, this system of equations, does not have a solution, or it doesn't have a unique solution. So this Fredholm alternative answers precisely these questions. So suppose we have L, self-adjoint differential operator, that is of nth order. And again, up to nth order, and n, that's n, but better say, right, n homogeneous, that's very important, homogeneous boundary conditions. Well, these are conditions that relate the derivatives of different orders between themselves. So if we have second order differential operator, I have written down two homogeneous two boundary conditions. So in general, for nth order differential operator, we have n conditions. So then, and here there are three important points. Point one, either here one is large, here one is small. Here capital I, here small I. Either Ly equal to F has a unique solution, or two, Ly equal to zero has a non-trivial solution. Non-trivial solution. By non-trivial, I mean non-zero. So because if you plug y equal to zero, this will be satisfied.
And homogeneous boundary conditions are like an expression of the form.
Also plus y prime. Yeah. And so forth. Yeah. So either this has a unique solution satisfying homogeneous boundary conditions, or Ly equal to zero has a non-trivial solution. So suppose L is such that alternative two holds. Here it has a non-trivial solution satisfying homogeneous somehow, satisfying homogeneous boundary conditions. Then we cannot claim that alternative one holds. Two. Two with large two i's. Here it is quite simple. F Ly equal to zero has. So if this alternative two holds, if Ly equal to zero has n linearly independent solutions. So does L dagger y equal to 0. So, this is simple for trivial for self-adjoint differential operators. This statement, and it's not that important, but nevertheless, it is mentioned in the textbooks. And point three, if alternative two, these two holds, that L acting on y equal to 0 has a trivial solution, holds, then L y equal to f has no solution, unless f is orthogonal to all solutions, unless f is orthogonal to all solutions of L dagger y equal to 0, or better to say L dagger yh equal to 0. Or in other words, if f comma L dagger yh put in square brackets equal to 0. Yeah. The weight function is, we assume that the weight function is 1 theta. Thank you very, very much. Yeah. Let's assume, right? Yeah. So one second. Sorry, it's a typo. Sorry, yeah. It was orthogonal to the solution. Thank you. Yeah, it must be orthogonal to solutions. Of course not, to solution itself. So I don't remember statements about weight functions, but if here we assume that W is equal to 1. That assumes. So what this means? So if there is a non-trivial solution due to the formal differential operator for some reasons, then point three states that the solution to the non-homogeneous problem is not only not unique, but it may not exist at all. It exists only if the right-hand side satisfies this condition. Of course, in this case, we also cannot talk about uniqueness, of course. So there are plenty of exercises. Just one. I have one very simple and last thing to tell you. There are plenty of exercises that allow you to check this Fredholm alternative, but unfortunately, there is not enough time for us to practice because it's all exercises are quite beautiful and allow you to see all those points based on specific examples. So, but we're not going to have the corresponding exercise due to the lack of time. But it's useful to remember, especially this last condition. It is very often used in theoretical physics when we try to find the solutions to nonlinear differential equations. Especially this alternative has quite many applications. Okay, and finally, the last thing, and we all go for lunch. Thing that is very known, very used, and very pleasant. It is very pleasant because it may give you much more straightforward way to obtain the Green's functions. And exactly this thing is most often used in applications in quantum mechanics and field theory. This is very simple. Eigenfunctions, expansion. So you may ask a very good question. Why did I spend so much time talking about self-adjoint differential operators? The reason is very simple. Self-adjoint differential operators, they possess a complete set of orthonormal eigenfunctions. Self-adjoint L possess of set of orthonormal eigenfunctions. And we can expand over them. This means that we can always find the solution to the following equation. L acting of psi of n as functions of x equal to lambda n phi of n as functions of x. These are eigenfunctions, and lambda n are eigenvalues. Moreover, if operator is self-adjoint, then eigenvalues can be found to be real. Well, as I said, truly self-adjoint. Let's talk about self-adjoint. We talk about truly self-adjoint when we impose the boundary conditions. And all lambda n not equal to zero. In this case, we can write down the expression for the Green's function g of x psi equal to sum of n. We assume that those eigenfunctions are real. Phi n of x times phi n of psi divided by lambda n. Well, proof is very simple. So since phi of n form a complete set, we have satisfied since phi of n of x satisfy the equation sum over n phi n of x phi n of psi equal to the delta function. This is the condition of completeness. We have operator X acting on the sum so it acts only on this equal to sum of n. So using this equation and substituting it into here, we have sum over n lambda n phi of n of x times phi n of xi divided by lambda n. Lambda n cancels, and this is equal to delta function according to the condition of completeness. So we thus this means that g of x xi equal to the sum phi n of x phi n of xi divided by lambda n. This expression for the Green's function is very compact, very vivid, but in order to obtain the full expression, one has to sum quite often the infinite series. Yeah. It is the same. I simply assumed that the eigenfunctions are real. It is the same. Yeah, it is the same. Well, when you do the expansion of the wave function, yeah, then you use the eigenfunctions of the Schrödinger operator, right? If the Schrödinger operator, say, contains the real potential, then you can always choose the eigenfunctions to be real. This is what I did for us, simplicity. Yeah, this is absolutely the same. So, okay, my friends, that's all I wanted to tell you. That's all for today. So during the tutorial, you will have practice with Green's functions.